Thanks very much, Reinhardt, and I'm delighted to be back at the. I'm very happy to be back at the Wissenschaft Center, where I made a first appearance and presentation in 1983, when the building was at the Luftbrück. It was quite some time ago, and it's very nice to be able to come back. I'm going to speak about empirical work, which has been summarized most recently in a book entitled Inequality and Instability, and that is based upon a research project that now spans about 16 or 17 years. And I do have a presentation that I will get to eventually, but I thought I would start by offering perhaps somewhat extended reflection on the larger context of the study, and then turning to the specific evidence that I have to show on the issue that is mentioned in the title, particularly the relationship between inequality, economic inequality, inequality in structures of pay, and unemployment, and the implications that that may have for the ongoing crisis. I want to begin by a word of qualification and caution. The study of inequality has suddenly become very fashionable after having been a backwater of research for a long time, certainly almost completely restricted to development economics in the first three decades or so following the end of the war. And in the last several decades, when the issue became an inescapable part of the discussion in the advanced countries, it has been substantially a matter of applied microeconomics. It has now become a very fashionable and compelling topic, and people who work on it, I think, are prone to, let's say, messianic temptations. That is to say, to interpret everything that's happening through the lens of economic inequality, and I shall attempt to resist this temptation and to give you a reasonably restrained account of what it is that I and my research collaborators have been trying to achieve. I don't wish to place inequality in a unique causal role, nor to argue that it has a transcendent moral or ethical significance. I think it's important, but I don't think it's the only important thing, and I don't think it's a universal explanation for the events through which we've been passing. I will make two claims that I think the evidence supports. The first is that the study of inequality has been for a long time delayed and confused by, first of all, a weak empirical foundation, a scarcity of good, reliable evidence that can be of measurements that can be compared across time and space, and from which solid conclusions can be drawn. That's on the one side. And on the other, in this ambiguous data environment, a proclivity to impose a priori theoretical ideas, and in particular ideas drawn from the analytical frameworks of neoclassical economics, that is to say, in particular from labor market analysis as it has developed in the advanced countries. So you have these two problems, a vacuum of data, not entirely a vacuum, but certainly a weak data foundation on which a structure of a priori beliefs has been imposed. That's the first claim. The second claim is that it is in fact possible to develop a stronger empirical foundation. Better data are quite readily available. They can be found in a wide variety of primary source documents. that they do repay study in revealing patterns of association movement through time that are in many ways quite simple and quite, compelling, and that broadly, measures of inequality derived from, in many cases, quite heterogeneous data sources provide sensitive measures of economic performance. I have been thinking about how to express what I think to be the significance of these measures in a simple way, and I've come up in recent days with an analogy that I think is quite appropriate to the case. It's useful to think about inequality as being analogous to the measurement of blood pressure in a biological organism as a measure of health. That is to say that there is a range of good outcomes, a range of outcomes which we can broadly consider to be acceptable, that within that range, lower is generally better, that is to say, is associated with a healthier, more vigorous organism. But it is possible to be too low if your blood pressure is too low, and I think if your inequality measure is too low, that will generally be associated with sluggishness and certain other problems that you may have. Inequality and blood pressure of zero are highly comparable. They will get you to the morgue in a short period of time. This is not a survivable situation, not to be found in living organisms. And then finally, that when the measure increases, when your blood pressure spikes, when it goes up rapidly, that is a sign of trouble. That is a sign of a potentially impending crisis. And I think, that, again, the same thing is true of inequality measures. So one can overdo metaphors and analogies, but this one strikes me as being quite useful in crystallizing what I would suggest are the essential characteristics of a good inequality measure. And it also helps to make a point about the relationship between a cause, a problem, and an indicator. If you have hypertension, high blood pressure, that generally has a deeper physiological cause. There's something behind it. You may be able to determine what that is. Maybe you can't. But you would generally expect that there is some deeper reason for this event. Nevertheless, it is also a problem in its own right with general implications, even if it has a wide variety of different causes. It's an indicator of risks in its own right. And it's also something which can be treated and controlled in many cases independently of the underlying causes. And again, I think this is also true of economic inequality. That is to say, there are steps that one can take irrespective of the forces that may be driving you to higher inequality, which will lower it. And those steps are, let's say, general to the measurement in the case of inequality. So, and again, in these respects, it seems to me, without trying to overdo this analogy, that it will help frame what it is that I'm trying to get at from the standpoint of the implications of this work. I'll make one further claim about the study of inequality and its relationship to the discipline of economics, and that's the following. Inequality, of course, is just another word for dispersion. It is the second moment of a distribution. And what we have typically done in economics when we think about distributions is to assign the first moment to one analytical domain and the second moment to something entirely different. That is to say, the rate of growth, the rate of unemployment, the rate of inflation, these things are assigned to macroeconomics, and the distribution of wages and prices and so forth, relative prices, has been assigned to microeconomics. And so we have separated out growth and cycles on one hand, and the relative valuations on the other. And the data, generally speaking, have been too poor to permit this very basic conceptual assignment to be evaluated. But with better data, I think it is possible to show that this separation is totally untenable. That the first and second moments are very closely related. The shape of distributions, therefore, I would argue, is fundamentally a macroeconomic phenomenon. Right? And that, I suggest, from the standpoint of economics, is quite challenging because I ask you, I suggest, those of you who are economists and published in this literature, that you go and look at the classification schemes in the Journal of Economics Literature that you're asked to put on every article that you submit, and find the appropriate classification code for the macroeconomics of inequality. Doesn't exist. Right? So to whom do you submit the article that makes this case? If I am right about this, and I think I am, then the study of market pricing, particularly as it applies to the wage structure, loses a very large part of its claim to explanatory power. So I side with Robert Lucas in his drive to obliterate the distinction between micro and macroeconomics, right, in which he has been, over the years, very largely successful. But I think he chose the wrong part of the subject to wipe out, that it is macroeconomics which gives us guidance to these issues, in these questions, and the microeconomics which becomes superfluous and redundant. Let me turn now specifically to the question that's addressed in the title of the talk, and the relationship between inequality and employment and unemployment. There are some of you, I think, who are old enough to remember what life was like before the great financial crisis in 2007, if it's possible. Yeah. And you will recall that there was, at that time, a grand unified theory of European and American unemployment. America was the land of the low unemployment rate. Why? Because we had a flexible labor market. Do you remember this argument? You haven't completely obliterated it from memory? It shows that you have dangerous tendencies. Europe, on the other hand, had high unemployment because of wage rigidity. Okay? Because of the inflexibility of the labor markets. But what is that? What is wage rigidity? Now, there are a number of indicators of it in the literature, but surely a central indicator of wage rigidity, conceptually, is the compression or decompression of the wage structure, the degree of inequality in the structure of pay, right? And the notion was that Europe had imposed on itself excessively egalitarian pay structures as a result of the work of trade unions and social democrats over many decades, work which was ostensibly not present in the United States. And if that theory were correct, then countries, regions with egalitarian pay structures should in principle be expected to have had higher rates of unemployment than countries with flexible and distended and disegalitarian wage structures, for the simple reason that the more egalitarian your wage structure, then the greater the potential for a mismatch between the skill set of your workforce and the underlying ability to pay people according to their marginal productivities. And that was the favored theory. In fact, it was the universally repeated doctrine of the policymaking class, certainly in Europe. It's worth noting, however, that it was not the only economic theory, even in the literature, and for that matter, even in the neoclassical literature, that had some bearing on these questions. There was a perfectly respectable model authored by Harris and Todaro back in 1970 in the development economics literature, which presented an argument with exactly the opposite implication. The Harris and Todaro argument held that in a situation in which you had a region with a wage that was a wage structure that was imposed by, let's say, a high minimum wage in the cities and a low wage in the surrounding countryside, that the differential would induce migration, and that you would then have, since the number of jobs available would be far less than the number of migrants seeking them, you would have unemployment associated with that differential. So it has exactly the opposite implication. The greater the degree of inequality, the more unemployment you would expect simply as a disequilibrium search phenomenon. And that doctrine was around there, but because the article was initially applied to East Africa, it had very little attention given to it as an argument about the way labor markets might function in advanced countries. And secondly, of course, in the case of the Scandinavian countries, there was the argument associated with Wren and Meidner underlying the Scandinavian model, which held on a long-term basis that a compressed wage structure would tend to enforce a discipline on the productivity of industries and businesses. That is to say, it was basically a regulatory argument that if you couldn't pay a competitive a minimum wage, then you would be basically obliged to out-migrate, and the resulting upgrading of the labor force and of the economic environment would bring in the high productivity firms. And over a long period of time, this argument predicted that your average income would rise relative to the surrounding countries, and that this would then be a part of the explanation for the relative success and rising income of Northern European countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, in relation to their southern counterparts over the decades from the 1930s through the 1990s. And meanwhile, as those societies got richer, then of course they could afford to employ larger numbers of people in low productivity services sectors, and so their employment rates would be higher and their unemployment rates lower as a result of an egalitarian structure of pay. So you had, again, two perfectly plausible theoretical concepts that ran in the opposite direction from the one that happened to become the dominant and favored one, but they were largely neglected in the literature. Well, if one decides to tackle this question from an empirical point of view, then you have to ask, what is the domain over which inequality is to be computed? It's fairly clear that we should focus on pay. Income is a very broad concept, particularly as measured in the tax records. But what is the geographic range that's appropriate? The broadly accepted view, the neoclassical view, simply evaded that question by taking the available data sets as defining the appropriate market. And the available data sets were all national. Therefore, institutions that were deemed to be the appropriate ones to judge labor market conditions were substantially considered to be national institutions, and that's the way the statistical work associated with this literature proceeded. But let's take the case of Europe and ask, even if this was appropriate in 1960, was it still appropriate in 1990? Was it appropriate in 2000? By which time Europe had become a single market in de facto and de jure terms, if not from the standpoint of workers, at least from the standpoint of multinational corporations and individual portfolio investors who could choose freely where to put their money? And if we are talking about a single market at the continental scale, from some appropriate conceptual standpoint, then how about measuring inequality at that scale? In which case, The measure of inequality needs to include the differences between countries, which had previously been ignored. And if that's the case, then one has to ask, is it still true that Europe is more egalitarian than the United States? Where, after all, we have been working for since the beginning with a national data set, and we have a national measure of these things. Right? You have to add in those between country differentials, what happens. The approach I'm going to talk about and show you has the advantage that you can change the conceptual framework basically according to the research question that you're attempting to analyze. You can look at regions inside Europe, let's say NUTS 1 geographic regions. You can look at countries, you can look at the continent as a whole. And then you can assign components of the unemployment rate to the appropriate level of analysis. It doesn't answer all the questions that you might want to ask, but it does seem to me to give you some very strong hints about the magnitudes and forces that are at play. So let me now go to the presentation and give you an overview of the project as a whole, and then come back to the specific issue of unemployment and inequality. I'll pass over that. That's a little motto which appears as the frontispiece of the book and associates us with Kepler. The work project here is something called the University of Texas Inequality Project. It's been underway, as I say, since 1996 or so. And there is a large body now of applied research which is available on the website of the project, including a large number of working papers and a half a dozen books, as well as the data sets that we've been using. It has a very simple conceptual foundation, and I'm not sure that the PowerPoint here is going to be able to give you the animation, but the entire mathematics of the measurement of inequality depends upon basically having two pieces of information that enable you to compute the first term on the left of the top expression. And the two pieces of information for a set of groups into which the data are divided, and these may be provinces or industries or sectors, any kind of group data, is a population weight for the group, how big is it as a share of the total population, and the average income of the group in relation to the average income of the total population. And that is information which is extremely easy to compute from all kinds of source data. So, for example, if you have, for China, a list of the provinces of China and the population, or let's say the employment of each province and the payroll in each province, then you can compute the average income for the total country, you can compute the average income of each province relative to the average for the country, the population weight for each province, you multiply it together, multiply that by the log of the income term, and you have the entire mathematics behind this project. So it's the between groups component of Tile's t-statistic, which is a member of the class of generalized entropy measures of inequality, closely related to information theory. And Tile, in fact, got it from Claude Shannon, who was developing it for computer science at MIT in 1948. There's the animation. That's what we do. When one takes, just for example, but it is the example on which a great deal of the work is based, the manufacturing database, the industrial statistics of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, and computes the between groups component of Tile's t-statistic across the entire globe, you get a distribution of observations roughly exactly like this for each decade in each major region, a total of almost 3,500 observations, which have the virtue of being systematically comparable one to the other, and largely annual for most of the countries in the observation set. So what one has here is a much denser and more comprehensive measure. It's a measure which only captures part of the structure of pay, but that part part is highly indicative as a rule of what's going on in the economy as a whole, and this gives you on the whole order of 4 or 5 times as many observations as you would get from using a collection of income surveys from the World Bank, at least in its original form, and the great advantage that the measures are in fact comparable one from the other, which the income surveys tend not to be. Okay, just to give you a feel for what the numbers look like, this is a plot of the average values of these between groups component of the top statistic and the range through time. And you can see, not surprisingly, that the North European and East European countries come in very low, that the North America and the rest of Europe come in roughly in the middle, and then you have developing countries that both have substantially higher inequality measures and substantially, in many cases, much more variable over the 30 or 40 years for which we have observations. No surprises really there, but it tells you that the measures are in fact quite comprehensive and quite in accord with your intuitive perceptions. Broadly, the data tend to support the initial argument offered in 1955 by Simon Kuznets, which held that the principal motion of inequality would come in intersectoral transitions from agriculture to industry, and that seems to be clearly true for countries that are still in that phase of economic development. China, of course, which is in the process of industrializing and still has a large rural sector, is experiencing rising inequality as it grows. But for countries like Brazil or Korea and many, many others, we find that inequality declines with growth. At the very top of the income spectrum, however, the relationship appears to turn the other way. And for a country like the United States, there is a tendency for economic booms to produce increasing inequality. And again, this is, I think, easily understood in terms of the intersectoral relationships going on. The United States exports advanced technology products and advanced, for example, financial services. In an investment in technology and credit boom, the incomes that grow most rapidly in the U.S. are not the working class incomes, but the incomes at the top of the scale, pay at the top of the scale. And so you get a kind of curvilinear or an augmented Kuznets relation as a foundation of the data, something which a great deal of the research in development economics had been unable to find from the previously available data sets. I won't go into that in great depth, but I could go on for substantially more on that point. A second crucial finding is that at the level of the world economy as a whole, we find a very strong common trend or pattern in the movement of inequality. And there are turning points which are clearly identifiable in 1971, in 1980, and 2000. This is the, I guess I'll come to that in a second. I want to show you, and I hope the transitions work here, the movement of inequality around the world in this data set with a very simple color scheme, the blues indicating increases, the pink to the red to the brown indicating the decreases. And this is over 6-year periods. If you look from in the 60s, you find a mixed pattern. Some countries increasing, some countries decreasing, a lot of gaps in the data. The gaps tend to go away as we fill in the middle period. In the 1970s, particularly in the oil boom, you can see that the oil-producing countries tended to have declining inequality. The oil-consuming countries tended to have increasing inequality as they entered into the recessions of the 1970s. Moving on, and you can see very clearly what happens in the debt crisis of the 1980s, rising inequality almost everywhere in the world, with the very significant exception of China and India, both of which were insulated substantially from the global debt crisis. And then finally moving on into the 1990s, and one more, can I go backwards? There we are. You have a continuing increase in inequality, now with the largest increases located in the former Soviet lands in Asia, with a significant exception in Southeast Asia, where you had a a boom that was fueled for at least a period up to the crisis of 1997 by foreign direct investment. But when you see those patterns right away, you can realize that the movement in this data is something which has a very strong regional co-association. Right? You see Latin America, Asia, Central Europe moving together. This is obviously not going to be the result of idiosyncratic policy choices at the national level, but something that's happening that affects these countries together and at the same time. And I suggest that the simplest way to interpret the pattern is to look and realize that the turning points coincide with the major changes in financial regime. The collapse of Bretton Woods occurred in 1971. You then had a global debt and commodities boom that affected a great many countries, that caused, in the case of countries on a declining Kuznets surface, to have declining inequality as they grew. That comes to an end in 1980-81, and then for 20 years you have debt crisis that cascades around the world and vastly increasing inequality, peaking finally in 2000 with the peak of the NASDAQ boom in the United States and the change to a low interest rate regime, which continues today. So that is the basic story of global inequality as a macro phenomenon generated by the changing character of the regime of global financial governance. If you look at an entirely different measure, this is what Branko Milanović calls his concept one inequality, inequality between countries measured from the Penn World Tables, entirely different data set, you can see it nevertheless has the same pattern. Decline in the 70s, turnaround in the 80s, and a rise up to the end of the century. It's also true that if you look at the pattern of profit shares in the OECD, again, the same pattern emerges. A decline in the 70s, a rise in the 1980s and 1990s. Which suggests, again, that what we're looking at here are three different ways of measuring exactly the same phenomenon. That is to say, functional share of income, international share of income, and interpersonal share of income are all responding to broadly the same global economic forces. That's the crucial finding in the book, and I'll now come shortly, I think. This is what George Soros calls the start of the super bubble, and it shows up at the same point in all three series. Okay, looking at the actual data, you find that on the left here, this is the pattern of numbers for the OECD and the upper bar is the non-OECD countries, both with a strong rising trend. If you took out the time element, which is basically the time of dummies in a two-way fixed effects model, what would be the effect on the overall trend of inequality? The answer is it accounts for all of it, which is in some statistical sense a truism, but nevertheless interesting to see. Okay. Let me turn now to the question of the relationship between inequality and unemployment from an empirical point of view. Again, we had the OECD job study back to 1994, in which you basically were looking at national institutions which need to be flexibilized along the American model, with the argument that Europe had to choose between job protection and employment. A very strong piece of the orthodoxy leading up to the crisis. There was also an alternative view, which one might call the varieties of capitalism approach or pluralist approach, which also accepted that employment was nationally determined in national labor markets, but said that different countries had different models, and in particular Scandinavia was special. Exactly how it was special was never entirely clear to me, and I actually asked Jean-Claude Trichet once at a luncheon meeting what he thought, and he said that they were special, but he couldn't explain why. So I offer the implication that if everyone were Danish, we all had lots of pretty blonde jobs and sticky pastries, but it's not entirely clear what the component that is transferable of that particular message. So, question is, can we come up with a unified theory which is broadly consistent with the facts? I'll show you a little bit of an effort to do so, drawing on a particular body of work that measured inequality in Europe across the European regions from the middle 1980s up to the end of the century. I'll skip over this. This has to do with the way the data sets that measured European structural rigidities were in fact constructed in a number of mainstream studies, and you can see that from an econometric standpoint it's hard to find a lot of variety in the X's in these matrices, which are scaled from 1 to 3, and with their union coverage it's practically 3 everywhere. So it's not a very satisfactory way to proceed. We'll move over it. What we did was to measure inequality across NUTS 1 regions up to 159 regions from 84 to 2000 using the methodology that I described a few minutes ago. Again, I'll skip over that. And then we constructed a very simple model in which unemployment would be determined by 4 factors. The growth rate in the region, the relative wealth of the region at the European scale, indicating, therefore, that where you are in Europe matters, not just where you are within your national economy. Both of those are expected to have negative coefficients, that is to say, higher growth rate, you have more construction, then you have lower unemployment. A higher degree of wealth, you have less unemployment. And then 2 supply factors, one simply the population share of young people, share under 25, and the other one being the pay inequality, along the lines that I described a few minutes ago. That is to say, with the idea that contrary to the mainstream view, a greater degree of inequality of pay would lead to a higher level of unemployment. And then in addition to that, 2-way fixed effects for country and time. Okay? This is the regression results, and I don't know exactly to what extent you and the audience are going to be interested in this as a technical matter, but it separates things out for the populations of the total population, male, female, under 25 and over 25, and one finds when one controls, particularly on the female under 25 and over 25, that the inequality measure is of the right sign and significant. The other measures, of course, as you might expect, do have the expected signs, and they're all highly significant. The degree of explanation in the model improves dramatically as you add country fixed effects in particular, and somewhat as you add time effects. So I think the model has some explanatory power, does not again put the inequality measure at the regional level in a prime moving position, but it does say that you can find an effect, and it does tend to refute the notion that regions with more flexible, more inegalitarian labor markets should have lower unemployment rates. In fact, quite the contrary, and particularly for the vulnerable populations. When you look at the country effects, this is what you find. I've calibrated them in such a way that the countries in white are in the middle of the spectrum. That is to say that they have no or very small variations between them. France is the country at the zero line. And even the Scandinavian countries are in the same general sphere as Germany, France, and Italy in this particular calculation. So what that suggests is that the model does not show Scandinavia to be exceptional. Its performance is simply an artifact of where it stands on the other variables that are in the model. The countries that are exceptional, well, Spain has exceptionally high unemployment in this period compared to the other countries as explained by the model, but there are 4 countries which have exceptionally low unemployment compared to what the model predicts. Not necessarily low in absolute terms, and in fact quite the contrary in some cases, but much lower than expected. And I would suggest that in the case of a country like Portugal, and perhaps also Greece, you're looking at a diaspora effect, small countries where unemployment tends to lead people to leave, in which case they're no longer in the labor force. In the case of Austria and Ireland, you're looking at the 2 countries of Europe which actually had the most rigid labor markets. And it was Richard Freeman who suggested that we take a look at that hypothesis, particularly for the Austrian case, so we did. And what we found was that if you just take a ratio of Austrian wages to German wages, you find that, in fact, in most of the non-traded goods, they're actually higher. But in the areas where particularly manufacturing, they are systematically discounted from the German equivalent, suggesting that the effect of the centralized bargain in the Austrian case was to give investors an incentive to locate traded good facilities in Austria, and that this would have a positive effect on Austrian employment relative to German. An advantage, in other words, precisely of being inflexible if you are a small country next to a large neighbor. And there's some evidence that Ireland played the same game with respect to the UK. There it is. Okay, moving on, just to look very briefly at the time effects. What the time effects tell you is what is the common movement of inequality across Europe in this period. And you can see that after the Maastricht Treaty, it goes up, and then with the euro, it comes down, of course, only up to the early 2000s in this data set. But you have a common movement, which suggests, again, that this is something which is where the numbers are quite significant. Those are actual points of the unemployment rate on the vertical axis. So you suggest that a significant part of the European unemployment rate here for each of the subpopulations, as well as the unemployment rate as a whole, can be attributed to factors that are common to Europe, perhaps larger than Europe, but given the institutional changes that are underway, it would seem to be most plausible to attribute them to the effects of the European integration policy as it was passing through this period. Turning, and finally, to the question of what you find for the United States, it is necessary to distinguish between pay inequality and income inequality, because income inequality, measured in tax data, has a very strong high income element associated with it, and I'll come back to that. But if you just look at pay inequality, and this is manufacturing, something you can do on a monthly basis going back to the 1950s, you find that it's very closely associated with unemployment, month to month. And so, again, the theory that suggests that this is largely driven by macroeconomic forces appears to be borne out in the data that we have collected. This is from employment and earnings data in the United States. Looking at income, on the other hand, where your income data are very strongly associated with the incomes of the very richest Americans, whether that is capital gains, stock options realizations, or salaries paid in firms that are drawing their revenues from the capital markets, you find that the inequality measure, this is measured between counties, has an extraordinarily close association with the log of the technology-based NASDAQ stock market index. It peaks at exactly the same moment, and the proportional changes are practically exactly the same up to about 2003. The one deviation here is in the moment of the Tax Reform Act of 1986, for reasons that I will avoid spending time on right now. Okay, the animation didn't work, but you can do a small counterfactual experiment here and show that if you simply take out from this inequality measure the effect of a handful of counties, the first line is what if you take out New York, Manhattan, you can see that the peak comes down, oh, I don't know, 10, 15, maybe 20%. If you take out Manhattan and Silicon Valley, three counties in Northern California plus King County, Washington, which is Seattle, Microsoft, it comes down by about half. And if you take out the top 15 counties, all of it goes away. So the rise in inequality measured across counties in the United States in the 1990s is practically 100% an artifact of the technology boom. There's just nothing else going on in the data, and you can remove the places where the technology boom companies were located, where their incomes are registered, and you can see that the pattern would have been dramatically different in that case. Okay, what do I have? All right. Moving on to the late 2000s, and I guess this is a little dark for the, to be very clear, you can make this kind of vertical map of the U.S. case. And once again, the biggest contributions to inequality are certainly associated with the extraordinary incomes in the financial sector. But now there are gains in other places that are not so evident in the earlier maps, including Southern California and Southern Florida. And so the data are showing in a very clear-cut way the consequences of the late stages of the real estate boom. It's a clear example of where the incomes are being recorded in construction, presumably, and in real estate transactions as a contribution to the movement of inequality. And what that tells you is while the top of the U.S. income spectrum is always the same, it's always the top executives of the major financial firms, just below that you have a moving party depending upon whatever it is that the financial firms are doing at that particular moment. In the intermediate period in the middle 2000s, 2003, the biggest bump is right around Washington, D.C., and what's going on there, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, increasing expenditure in the military budget. And you see it just pops up on the chart as a manifestation of the increasing wealth of the capital area. I'm going to that. That suggests to me, just by way of conclusion, that there is a lot of work that can still be done, and a lot of work going forward which can, I think, advance the project of analyzing the effect of inequality as a macroeconomic phenomenon and establishing what is in fact happening in the wake of the crisis in the United States and in the ongoing crisis in Europe. I think we will find that, so far as inequalities of pay are concerned, that once you measure them across the European topography across the European continent as a whole, that they are widening very dramatically, that the previously well-established gaps between Germany and the periphery are getting substantially larger, and that is a sign that the crisis is deepening. It's obviously the only sign, and so I won't claim too much for it. This is something you can know by reading the papers, and it's something you will know first by reading the papers, so I won't indicate that inequality is an advance indicator of here. But I think to understand what inequality is and what it does is still a very useful addition to our understanding of macro dynamics. Thanks very much.